Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
What is it? I don't know.
A classic selection there from Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. Great holiday movie treat there. But NASA is really launching its Mars Science Laboratory into space this weekend. And the spacecraft is equipped to test to see if there is methane in the air. It could be a key sign that there is life on Mars, or at least that the planet may be able to support life, which would have a lot to do with whether Earthlings decide to go there. Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson is the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. He's also the host of Star Talk Radio and joins us in the studio this morning. Thanks for getting up for us.
I'm happy. I don't live that far from you.
That's right.
You're an easy
date. That's right. Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
Yes, I did. Thank you. I did not overeat.
Excellent.
Nowadays, that means it's good.
Neither did I. I think I went to bed before it was even served.
I didn't even have to unbuckle my belt. I think it worked.
So this is the first major space mission since the shuttle program was mothballed, and in a sense, we've lost our manned space connection with space exploration. How are you feeling about this mission?
Actually, mothballed implied that you're going to pull it
right,
out
later. Right, exactly. It's
no,
done.
Just done.
Kaput, right.
Done.
Right.
So it's a good feeling to be reminded that NASA can still launch something, in spite of it not containing people, but it contains a very powerful suite of scientific instruments that are going to another planet. So this is how we've been exploring planets ever since the early days, early 1960s, our first mission to Mars.
And it's been some exciting technology. I mean, we watched the Mars rovers, who had at one point the most popular website on planet Earth.
Yeah, in fact, for a while there, they had more web traffic to the rover's website than the world traffic in pornography. So that was the real measure
it's a sign of life on planet Earth.
I felt really good about that.
That's amazing.
There's hope for the world.
Well, what technological wizardry is involved in this laboratory that takes us even beyond the Mars rovers?
That's an important and excellent question. You have to remember that once you've tested a technology, there's a very strong urge to want to use it again and again and again because it worked, it didn't break, you have it characterized in situ for how it would perform. But then you realize that at some point you got to try something new because you have new questions that have been opened by the previous technologies. So one of the most simple needs of a spacecraft is to land on Mars. And the previous ones, the previous rovers,
right,
landed with airbags. You
right,
remember
that's right.
This.
They inflated these airbags once they were in the atmosphere and bounced.
They
literally
just simply bounced.
Right.
And you sort of strap down the instrument and let it bounce to a halt. And then it opened up like a flower. And in so doing, you ensure that the airbag was underneath it.
Uh-huh.
And then it just rolls off. In this mission, the Mars Science Laboratory, it is much bigger than those
right,
earlier missions.
So you can't
missions.
Necessarily bounce it.
Yeah, you know, first you don't want to bounce it. And it's the size of an SUV, like a full-up equipped SUV. And so one of the concerns was that if you deployed it by parachute, the parachute might land on top of it, and then it wouldn't be able to shake it loose.
And you've got a thin atmosphere in Mars, so the parachute dynamics aren't quite the same
as it would be in the Earth. It just means you need a bigger parachute
right.
to hold, you know, but Mars also has less gravity, so the two sort of work together.
There you go.
Yeah. So it has an innovative descent mechanism where the spaceship comes within the spaceship that contains the rover.
Right.
Rover, I shouldn't even use the word rover. Rover, you think of a little thing.
Yeah.
It is an automobile.
It's an Escalade.
It's the big Cadillac, I guess, the Escalade.
Yeah, there you go. A little product placement here on the show. Yeah.
I wonder if the hubcaps are doing interesting things on this one. So you bring it down, and there's a deploying platform that suspends itself with retro rockets and then hoists down the craft by wire.
Oh, wow.
Gives it a soft landing. And then breaks away, and so there it is.
So it's like in two pieces, the platform plus the
exactly,
the lab.
Exactly. So I'm worried that it's the first time we're testing on such a very expensive instrument. But
we've had problems with previous missions that sort of vanished without a trace.
Yes, Mars is a tougher target than it otherwise seems. When it's successful, it sounds like it's easy, but you got to rack up you got to tally all the ones that didn't succeed.
Although we've got some infrastructure up there this time around, we have a more or less permanent orbital presence around Mars. Isn't that the case?
Yes, we do. And that's quite important because not only did that orbital presence give us photographic reconnaissance to alert us with very high resolution detail where we should land to perform the experiments we'd like, it also provides a radio transmission station back to Earth. So it's very we're basically setting up camp there on Mars. So this mission is designed to primarily look for organic chemistry.
What's the name of the mission?
Well, it's the Mars Science Laboratory, which got named Curiosity.
Curiosity. Well, there you
go. They're always naming contests, and this one, Curiosity, is great. Once you look for organic compounds, you get a sense of whether Mars could have ever sustained life or currently sustains life. And the area that was chosen is a circle about the size of Manhattan. Manhattan is elongated, but take about 15 miles on a side.
Got it.
So we're going to launch from Earth and land inside that circle. By the way, this deployment mechanism allows you to land with much greater precision than the other rovers. And in so doing, it says now you can target. You can say, I know exactly where I want to go because that's a ravine that shows water. In fact, it's landing in an alluvial plain, if you remember from your high school job.
Which would be the lowlands would be where the organic compounds would be likely to be hiding.
Exactly. They would have come out from the action of flowing water. And so it's not only checking for organics. There are instruments. There's a whole suite of instruments. Spain and Russia are part of that suite.
Interesting.
And it's going to analyze the atmosphere and the soils and the the rock compositions and there's a radiation detector.
Right.
It's also going to look to see if there's water anywhere beneath the surface.
How different is the question of whether there was once life on Mars and whether Earthlings could actually concoct together some sort of sustaining environment up there? Are those two independent scientific questions?
Yes, they are. And you want to terraform the place. That's what you're saying, I guess.
I don't know. Is there a plan?
That's
is there enough
for
methane?
Terraform.
All right, we got to bring oxygen, but we don't need methane. Well, they found that up there. You know what I mean?
So if we find water under the surface, then that's hydrogen and oxygen, H2O, and that's actually rocket fuel if you can separate them. And the act of bringing hydrogen back together with oxygen is highly exothermic, highly releasing of energy. In fact, the main tank of the space shuttle, the orange tank, did just that. Combine hydrogen and oxygen for fuel. So once you have water, you can drink it. You can use it for fuel. But Mars is really cold and really dry otherwise. And so you'd have to set up a whole habitat if you want to go hang out there.
Talking with Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, also host of Star Talk Radio. You want to stick around for a little while?
I can if you got a minute.
Yeah, sure. Can you stay at the end of the hour? You think about stuff other than science,
right? We're talking
about
Mars. We'll take any minutes you can give me.
Yeah, but you can talk politics too, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Can we get you out of your comfort zone?
Space politics.
Since you came in here?
Take me there.
All right, very good. Neil deGrasse Tyson will stay with us. Now, we've just been talking with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's an astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, host of Star Talk Radio, about the launch of the Mars Science Laboratory, which is going to go into space on Saturday. The name of the lab is Curiosity. And, Neil, I wanted to ask you about another project that you're working on. I gather sometime the year after next, in 2013, you're scheduled to host the sequel to Carl Sagan's, the late Carl Sagan's 13-part TV series, Cosmos.
That's
an amazing set of shoes to step into there.
A huge undertaking, and yes, an extraordinary set of shoes. I would say that those shoes are actually filled by multiple people now. If you, at any time you channel surf today, you'll stumble upon some show on science, particularly up at the Science Channel, or at least a respectable show.
Channels, yeah, exactly. Well, Carl Sagan, let's just remind people, a scientist himself. Was a favored guest on the Johnny Carson show.
Exactly, on the Tonight Show. And that was without precedent for a scientist, a serious scientist, to go and reach the public in their own habitat.
And since Sagan, there's always been perceived a need for a popularizer of science, an evangelist of science. And in a sense, you're stepping in part into that role.
Yeah, thanks for thinking of it that way, but I'm surely not feeling that alone. Like I said, yeah, Brian Greene has a very
absolutely,
successful series
yes, indeed.
On PBS Nova. There's Michio Kaku, there's Phil Plait, there's a lot of people out there.
As there should be.
I think that as there should have always
science
have been.
Science is complicated.
And part of it is not only whether the popular media will receive us, another dimension of this is whether the professional community will embrace the activity. And Carl Sagan transitioned for the expectations of what the scientific community might allow for one of its own members.
Well, he also, sat astride this domain of science where scientists are constantly focused on where's the next grant, which is one audience. versus the popular audience, where you're just trying to get people more fluent in scientific ideas, which may not result in grants, but it does sort of lift all boats.
Well, it does lift all boats, and probably in the end results in more grants, because you vote for candidates for Congress who are more charitable to the moving scientific frontier. What people don't realize is, yeah, there's a lot of great science just to think about emotionally, just the great quest to discover and to learn more. But at the other end of that, what you have to realize is that you're stoking a scientifically literate environment in which you're being raised, in which you're conducting your work, and it's that environment that stimulates the growth of entire new economies.
Right. Innovation and all that.
Innovation. That's the key word.
Do you think part of the interest in science media and science books and the World Science Festival here in New York, you mentioned Brian Greene, you mentioned your own work, has to do with people feeling like, you know, things aren't going well. The scientists need to help us out here a little bit. People are deciding to pay more attention to science as a way out of some of the frustrations.
I think that's not only is that true, I also think that because of access to the media, the internet, of course, leading the list of that, there what would might have been previously an obscure scientific result can actually come straight to the front. For example, the fact that a neutrino might be moving faster than light.
And which we've done on this program, and that's still trying to be confirmed.
Exactly.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. Thanks so much.
All right. Excellent.